The best of the 60s. You could say the best of the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, you could.
Yeah, and Ian has said about me, Bob is not very extraordinary in his mind. He's never had original thought in his head. I get a total put down from Ian. But then I know that that's a compliment, because Ian says that ascension is not a thinking man's game, and I can't think, so I'm well on the way, and that's why Ian showed up to me.
Hmm.
So I have the energy of questioning, but I have no clue what, anything about the answers. I'm just good at keeping the questioning going.
Yeah, that's what Carolyn's there for, right?
That's right. Yeah. You will hear that in the private sessions. Carolyn doesn't have to ask questions. Ian pours everything out to Carolyn. You know, no questions asked. You just maybe a couple of clarifications, but Carolyn doesn't have to pull it out of him. I have to pull it out of Ian often.
Because right. You don't think, and Carolyn does. That's why.
Yes, and also maybe Carolyn can understand Ian, especially in her field, faster than I can. I don't get it right away, so I have to find out what the fuck they just said, so it does get slowed down. But for other people, the questions are good that I come up with, you know, because they don't get it either. They need questions.
Listen, Bobby, I've known you for a long time, and I always love the fact that you're relentless in your questioning.
Yeah, as a kid, they used to complain about me. Why are you always asking why? You know, it's like a 8-year-old telling me this.
Right,
I'm 8.
Right.
And he says, you're always asking questions. I think that I was not even human, and I was faking being human. I had nothing to say, so I had to fake it by pretending I was interested. And I thought asking questions indicated interest in what the person said.
Right.
Well, yeah, and there's a good boost for culture, because that's true.
Yes. And Greg Skinner, he met me in 75 at the Art College Loft and First in New York City, the Halifax Art College Loft. And he just hitchhiked in from California. He'd been a student at the college in Halifax. So he got to meet Nam June Paik, John Cage, a whole bunch of other, Ken Kesey, Paul Krasner, through me, those couple of weeks he was staying at the loft when I was there. In April, May 75. And so all the people that he studied or heard about at art school in the early 70s, he never had any access to them until he met me. Okay, so he met them all in New York through me, because I knew where they all were, and I would go to whatever they were doing and interact with them. So he was really appreciative of that. But he said the thing he learned from me was that no matter how dumb the person is talking to you, if you ask questions about their dumb topics or whatever they're talking about and show an interest, it actually is profitable. So my technique of asking questions can prove useful in your social, phatic, boring life.
Yep. Amen.
Amen.
And asking questions is the finest way to derail an aggressor.
That's right. Yes. And let's see, what would be the opposite of that? It's the finest way to derail a passive-aggressive person.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Show interest in their ridiculous self.
Exactly.
Another indication of my ability to do that, when Eldridge Cleaver, Tim Leary, Paul Krasner, Abby Hoffman, all those people in the 60s came to Ryerson one time in 1985 or so. So Ian Arlett and I went to the panel, and it was a very good, interesting panel. Eldridge Cleaver, the black activist, had become a born-again Christian, pro-Reagan. Yeah. He freaked everybody out. So they all presented their stuff and argued in that. And then after, on the stage, a guy comes up to me, a loser, nerdy-looking guy, And I get talking to him because I'll talk to anybody. And he turns out to know about Spotlight magazine. He was a reader of Spotlight, which is a far right wing anti-Semitic bullshit place, a thing, which was but still pretty good in what it showed, is top down facts or fake facts. Anyways, here was just somebody in Toronto. I was getting the Spotlight. He was getting it. So we were talking about it. After a while, Ian comes over and he drags me away from the guy. He says, "You're missing the fucking interaction with Abbie Hoffman, for fuck's sake, Bob. Get over here and listen to Abbie Hoffman," you know, which I would have liked to have done. And he drags me over there, and that's right when Abbie Hoffman finished. So I missed Abbie Hoffman because I was talking to an idiot, far-right, anti-Semitic guy.
Right.
And because I was interested in him, you know, like, it shows you my personality. I look for the stuff in the fringes, in the ignored places.
Well, cool.
And all those ignored places are now archetypal. You have to realize how much Zappa was ignored, how much McClune was ignored, and May Brussel, LaRouche, they're all ignored completely. And nobody ever heard of them who was around back then.
Now they're halfway to beatification.
Yeah. Every one of them.
Yep.
Even LaRouche. LaRouche is celebrated in China because he predicted the Belt and Silk Road.
Oh. That's cool if that's true. If they're like, hey, who are our few, like, allies on this in the West? And
right.
If he's actually on their radar, that's cool.
Well, he is ill, or he's just not out there in the public so much, so his wife is. And she is often on Chinese TV as the top lady from the West who understands the development of the Belt and Silk, because LaRouche was writing about it and proposing it 25 years ago.
Right.
So there's okay, so he's persona non grata in North America, but he is celebrated in a, you know, culture with 2 billion people or whatever it is. That's well, why does he have to be popular here and go to another part of the world and become make it?
Yeah,
right. I mean, he's always less popular than I, you know, feel like he ought to be, but he does have a little bit of a popularity or a respect, or sometimes a grudging respect or a slowly growing respect in the conspiracy or parapolitics world.
Right.
As people, you know, I mean, when people are introduced to the fact that, like, this guy was ahead of the curve on, you know, just a lot of the topics about, like, you know, they made a movie about Gary Webb, but Lyndon LaRouche came out with Dope Inc., like, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And they, all the Alex Jones world is LaRouche replayed.
Right. Well, it's amazing that The Simpsons name dropped him, always in a mocking way or whatever, but they name dropped Lyndon LaRouche. You know, he was like the Alex Jones or something of The Simpsons, but with his own way, you know, I mean, because it was someone who was running for president. And,
yeah.
I mean, there's that one point where Homer famously says, "Oh my God." He's like, or he doesn't say, "Oh my God," but he says, "Lyndon LaRouche was right."
Many people. By 2000, once everybody got on the internet and then was reading all this conspiracy stuff, it seemed to be the main genre for people. They learned about that stuff that they wouldn't have without the internet. I met a lot of people through 2000s say, you know, that LaRouche guy, man, he was ahead of his time. He was right. You know, I've heard many people say this. And somebody said, why isn't LaRouche the big hero? Why Alex Jones? Well, it's because people don't read. Right? And LaRouche is mainly a journalistic operation, a news network. So I'm in touch with them, and they just sent me a whole bunch of his books that the group of them did over the last 20 years, or 15 years. A lot of interesting books, and they did a new update of Dope Inc. They've done many, but...
Oh, did they?
Yeah, and you look through it, they got graphs, they got incredible detail. If journalism is obsolete, they're the monks of journalism. They still track everything.
Right. They have that vibe.
Yes. And
they have that monkey vibe, you know.
Yeah, and they sent a magazine all about Mueller, Robert Mueller, you know, trying to have a coup against Trump, and they're an expert on Mueller because Mueller is the guy who put LaRouche in jail in the 80s.
Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I'm looking through the magazine. It's all these data about Mueller and what an asshole he was in the 80s and dealing with LaRouche. You know, all that historical stuff from 30 years ago is in the first part of the magazine.
Wow.
Nobody else knows that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mm-hmm. So he put LaRouche away, and he was rewarded. He got to replace J. Edgar Hoover. He became the new director of the FBI because he took on the toughest hombre in the town. He took on LaRouche and whooped him.
Yeah. Huh.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
There's a famous quote by LaRouche. What?
Just he's got a long history, Mueller, yeah.
Yeah.
People don't know.
And you imagine if you're taking over Hoover's role. I don't know. What do you know? What do you have to do? And but so LaRouche, way back in the 70s, said, there's going to be no revolution in the United States without me. Okay? So they have that quote. No revolution without LaRouche, says LaRouche. And then beside it is Henry Kissinger going, LaRouche is persecuting me. Two great quotes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at a dialogue, an interview with Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, and he did a big book on Kissinger. And he had some interesting things to say. That's his proudest book because, you know, we have these international justice courts and only losers get taken up, like Slavovic or whatever his name was, of Serbia or Yugoslavia, and the guy in Chile, Pinochet, they get hauled up to these courts because they lost their wars and they're found guilty. And so Christopher says the most important question for our time is, can we take the people who represent democracy and fight around the world for democracy, the United States, and take one of their guys and be a war criminal? Is that possible? And he says Kissinger is just so much data against Kissinger. If he was not, you know, in charge of the United States, he'd be immediately hung and quartered if you put his stuff
right
before an international tribunal.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting point of Christopher Hitchens. Of course, LaRouche thinks Hitchens is pure British propaganda, part of the Fabian Socialist Network grouping that came out of the 60s. It's interesting the debate between LaRouche and Hitchens.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed Bill Weinberg. You might have heard that one, the activist in the Lower East Side. He specializes in saving Aboriginal groups and third world minority cultures. I was going to bring up LaRouche, or it got brought up. And he says, that's a whole other topic. I can't go into that because Bill Weinberg is part of the gang in New York City that fought with LaRouche since the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so you can't bring up LaRouche to them.
Well, yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, LaRouche made that statement about the British Empire, or the British, you know, having a coup against Trump. And, of course, the British means the financial oligarchy of the City of London, in LaRouche terms. So this leftist guy in Toronto, I posted on his page. He says, you can't put that crap on my page. And I said, did you read it? He says, yeah, I read the first sentence and I vomited. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
LaRouche is a leftist. In many ways, he's a leftist. And he's an expert on the history of leftism and Marxism and all that. And yet the lefties can't take him. They really don't see any value in what he does. But he names the names in, like, whatever happened this past week that you haven't even know about, they've already put out a press release on whoever got named in this week's stories with their history going back 50 fucking years of what they all did.
Right.
you know, instant amazing journalism.
At least it's like, you know, if I mean, there's this big demand for undermining Mueller's credibility. But, like, who has a big, long article about this guy's history of...
bullshit, yeah.
You know, bullshit? It's the LaRouche folks.
That's right. And so Reiner, you get Reiner and those guys up in Buffalo with that critical art ensemble, and they get the little books out of Semiotex Press or that press in Brooklyn, Autonomedia... in the art schools, these guys have their nice little book. You've seen Steve's book, right, Reiner?
Yeah.
You know, they have nice little books. It gets distributed to the universities and the art schools. And those kids have no clue of the real underground in terms of very interesting information that a naturally critical art student would be interested in. That comes from LaRouche, but they're not allowed to even be mentioned in LaRouche land. I went to the School of Visual Design or something like that on 14th Street in New York. They had a big panel and had all the art professors there. This is back about 2005 or so. And I'm in the audience, and they lay out their stuff, the art world's archetypes. And I said, I stood up and I said, all that you're saying needs to be backgrounded by William Irwin Thompson, Marsha McLuhan, and Arthur Croker, and Lynn LaRouche. Immediately a professor says, well, I agree with all your names except for LaRouche. Do not mention LaRouche.
Yeah, that sounds like U.S.
Art school. But you don't get that objection in Toronto. They know nothing about LaRouche. Never heard of him.
Yeah, there you
go. Well, exactly, yeah. He's not even verboten up here. He's who?
No, he's
whatever. I don't know about up here, but these days, whatever, I don't know, among most normies or whatever.
Right, like that's why...
no more penetration.
That's why it was fun doing LaRouche on CKLN. Because nobody knew nothing about him, so there was no objection. So there were a lot of people say, oh, I like that LaRouche stuff. I like the executive intelligence review, the dumb Torontonians would say. and then eventually, when we played our long interview with LaRouche, the only people who could know and would know are as the Jewish Defense League or whatever the Jewish... defense mechanism is in Toronto. They called up and complained to the station for allowing LaRouche to be broadcast.
Wow. Yeah, right.
They're the only ones. Okay, is there something else we could talk about, Reiner? What? Come on, Reiner, come up with something.
I'm waiting for that 4X thing. I'm getting tired now. It's like early in the morning here now, right? So I'm getting to the point where I got to think about hitting the stack soon.
You're a harassed bureaucrat. From September, October, you're a harassed bureaucrat. Got to deal with all these kids. You got to talk to everybody every day, right? Figure out their courses.
Yep. And a lot of grad students. So, yeah, you know, they kind of wear me down for the first month, and then I settle in and don't give a shit anymore.
So you are a teacher of grad students.
Yeah, I teach undergrad and grad, yeah.
Oh. And where do you stay during the week in Buffalo?
No, I still commute back to Grimsby.
You go back every day, every night?
Yeah.
Well, how many hours is that ride?
It's only an hour. It's like super easy. I mean, I never have any traffic issues, and it's never a problem. It's super fast.
So
it's better than trying to get to Toronto. When I did things in Toronto, it can take you 2 to 3 hours to get the
that's right.
An hour ride. So we're going back into Buffalo is super easy.
Did you ever hear me explain that the bad traffic, you know who caused that?
Mm-hmm.
In Toronto?
Yeah, who caused it?
McLuhan.
Why, because he fought the Spadina Expressway?
That's right. Nelson Thal and I, we'd be driving around Toronto in the 80s or 90s and be stuck in a traffic jam. And Nelson, you know, who promoted McLuhan a lot, he'd sit back and go, Just think, that's fucking McClure. He caused this.
He stopped that expressway, yeah.
Yeah. It might have ruined Toronto, but there wouldn't be the horrible traffic jams, though some people say, nah, there'd still be terrible traffic jams. Spadina wouldn't have fixed anything. So,
well,
somehow it didn't occur to them.
Yeah. What are you saying, Brian? What didn't occur to them?
Somehow it didn't occur to them to just build the damn highways like 10 lanes or whatever, just more than, you know, three or four.
Right. They
like
thought
just that there was a vision that, like, we'll never need more than four lanes. Like, now we're like, we can't expand them anymore, damn it.
Right. Okay, so we've got Anonymous, we got Sean, and we have our McLuhan FOMO scholar, Jason. You must be inspired by our conversation, Jason. You must have something to say.
Did you call me a homo?
Yeah, I called you a homo.
No pomo.
I said pomo. P.
Oh, pomo.
Okay, you homo fucker. What do you have to say? Oh,
nobody.
Pomo? You don't know what Pomo means?
What does Pomo mean?
Postmodern.
No. Oh, Pomo. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you're the postmodern. You're the only guy who's read Deleuze and Croker and Baudrillard and these things. The only guy here.
Virilio. He passed away.
Yes, yeah. And you know what?
Yeah.
About a week ago, walking home from the beach, and I said, you see, I just stocked up on all my Virilio books. I just bought a whole bunch 2 months ago just to complete my Virilio library because, you know, he was talking back to McLuhan. And so I was just thinking, he's pretty old. I wonder if he's going to die soon.
86.
So I was thinking that. And I come home, and then about 7 days later, I found out he did die, and that he died around the day I was thinking of it. So there's my ESP. I hadn't thought about him too much. All of a sudden, I'm thinking about him dying, and because he came to me after he died. Hey, Bob, I'm dead. Talk to me, Bob. Talk to me.
Wow.
I got a
picture out of a magazine just a week ago.
We missed it, Brian. What did you do?
I cut his picture out of a magazine a couple weeks ago. I was cutting lots of pictures out of various newspapers and magazines, thinking about making a collage, but I had this old Vice magazine with the Vice interview with Paul Virilio, and there's this nice big picture of him, like, smiling, and he looks amused, and... Anyway, so I had cut that out. I hadn't put it on my wall yet, but then so I heard he died, so I put it up on the wall.
Well, you would have cut him out about the time he died.
No, it was more like probably a week before. I was sitting in the folder for a bit.
Well, you know, Club 22, we kill a lot of people, and that was probably you, me thinking about him, and you cutting out his picture. He just couldn't take it. He couldn't survive the attention.
Bud.
Never stop. Never stop.